If I can have everyone's attention, please. It's time to start the substance of the program. I'd like to thank you all for coming today. I'm Henry Olson. I'm the Vice President for Programs and the Director for the Center for Civic Innovation at the Manhattan Institute. And it's my pleasure and honor to be introducing the man who will be introducing our speaker today. Steve Goldsmith is the founder and chair of the Center for Civic Innovation, which we started about 10 years ago this month. And he is known as both being an enterprising policy implementer and policy thinker, and first achieved national prominence as mayor of Indianapolis in the mid-1990s, when he took a city that was troubled and was in financially rocky terrain and implemented perhaps the most innovative program of financial and program management of any place in the country at that time, one that became a model for hundreds of other cities, both in this country and in other countries, and has also become model for many state governments as well, and perhaps served as a inspiration to the president's performance management system, which he has instituted at the Office for Management and Budget. And thanks to Steve, we became very interested in policy development in the urban area, and he directed us towards a number of the leading innovations and implementers of those innovations throughout the last decade, for which we are very grateful. Today, Steve is the Dan Paul Professor of Government at the John F. Kennedy School at Harvard University, where he also directs the Innovations in Government program, and he is the chair for the Corporation for the National Community Service, which is the umbrella organization that runs AmeriCorps for the federal government. So please join me in welcoming Mayor Steve Goldsmith.
Thanks, Henry, and thanks to Manhattan. Henry didn't mention that the reason that he brags about my accomplishments is because I read about them through Manhattan Institute publications and City Journal, and then I implemented them, and then they invite me back to compliment me on my judgment, so I certainly appreciate it. Let me just say very briefly, I'm honored to have this opportunity to introduce a great governor. This is a very difficult time for mayors and governors around the country. The pressures that they face and the structural deficits that they've inherited make providing quality services particularly challenging, and the old status quo process of raising taxes to do it without changing government is clearly failing and won't succeed in the future as the deficits get greater and the problems get more challenging. Governor Romney, as you all know, has a distinguished career in almost every sector. The spectacular successes in the Salt Lake Olympics at a very difficult time for the country with a budget of approximately $400 million and 25,000 volunteers organized to precision. His work in the philanthropic areas, I noticed that he's still involved with Points of Light and City Year, two of the preeminent areas for volunteerism in the country, and the tremendous work that he's done in Massachusetts looking at ways to reform healthcare and education. All have garnered him a national recognition. I was thinking, kind of in closing as I introduced him today, that many of us were inspired by Myron and Manhattan's compassionate conservatism, which says there is a role for government to help individuals. And I think there's probably no better example in the country today of compassionate conservatism making government effective in the right ways with the marketplace than Governor Romney. Please help me welcome Governor Romney to the stage.
Thank you, Steve, for that generous introduction. My wife is not standing up to be introduced, but I'm going to take the occasion anyway. This is such an honor for she and I to be here, and also my daughter-in-law, who is married to my son, who just moved to New York. If Mary would stand and my wife Ann would stand, also be recognized. Thank you. In some respects, this is a... this is it. When you get to speak to the Manhattan Institute, you've made it. I turned to Anne as we were walking in the room, and I said, "Sweetheart, in your wildest dreams, did you see me addressing the Manhattan Institute someday?" And she said, "Sweetheart, you weren't in my wildest dreams." I'm honored to be introduced by Mayor Goldsmith. His work as the mayor of Indianapolis, his work in the administration, his work now with the Corporation for Public Service is legend, and it's an honor to be able to be with him and to be introduced by him and to be with you. Now, my career has not followed a very predictable course, as the mayor indicated. I could have never imagined that a white male Mormon millionaire businessman, Republican conservative, would be elected governor of Massachusetts. My job at the Olympics, however, was an even greater stretch in some regards. For those who know me well, they know that I'm not a great athlete. I've never organized a major event of some kind. My five sons and I have athletic competitions in the summer. I typically come in last. And so when I told them I was taking the job to run the Olympics in Salt Lake after it got into some tough waters there, they were a little surprised. But when they saw it in the paper, my oldest son called and he said, "Dad, I've talked to the brothers. We've seen this morning's paper. We want you to know there's not a circumstance we could have conceived of that would put you on the front page of the sports section." Now, what I actually do kind of well, if I have to choose something, is analysis. You might think, no, that can't be. I used to work with Fleur Harlan. We were at the Bossing and Salting Group, Bain and Company after that, working in a consulting business. And some of you have hired consultants before. My guess is your perspective or your attitude about them is not terribly stellar, but we loved what we got to do. And then having done that for a while, I decided that we could do a lot better if instead of just giving other people advice, we actually bought companies or started companies and tried to implement some of our own ideas. And it worked pretty well. And we acquired a number of businesses. We bought Domino's Pizza. We bought Duane Reade right here. We bought Sealy Mattress. We bought the Yellow Pages of Italy. We paid over $1 billion for that. Can you imagine? We started Staples, the Sports Authority. Over 100 companies bought or started over the 15 years or so that I was at Bain Capital, and we did remarkably well. And think about how that works, because you're acquiring a company like from Tom Monahan, the founder of Domino's Pizza. He started it in college. He bought the first store for $600. The first pizza store he made at Domino's. We're buying it from him when he thinks it's the best time to sell. And we're paying a huge price, a huge multiple, and we're coming in who know nothing about the pizza business, convinced we're going to make more money at it than he did. And to be able to do that successfully really suggests that you got something that works pretty well. How do you do it? I am not one of these gut feel guys who comes into something and says, "I have a feeling this pizza is going to be worth a lot of money someday." I know there are people who do that, who have a firm of 5 or 6 or 10 people and billions of dollars, and they put a billion here and a billion there. And that's not what we did. We hired hundreds of people at our firm, Bain Capital, and we'd study and analyze. It's what I love best, wallowing in data, organizing it, analyzing it, putting it through a conceptual framework that seemed to work for me, and then making decisions based on that. Now, when I went to the Olympics, we took very much the same approach. I thought going from the private sector to the quasi-public sector, the Olympics, it'd be entirely different, but it wasn't. I came in, there was a $379 million budget gap. We had extraordinary problems. We approached it the same way we would have approached a business problem. We got the games turned around. The games turned out to be fabulous in a number of dimensions. We generated almost $100 million of surplus, and we were very, very pleased. I came into the state. And when I was running for office, we had these debates where we just talk about how we were going to balance the budget when we got in there, my opponent and I. And I knew that in Tim Russert's last debate where he moderated, I knew he was going to ask me a question. How will you balance a $1 billion shortfall? And I'd seen him ask a similar question of Governor Jeb Bush in Florida a few weeks before. So I figured he'd use, the same material. And so I prepared my answer, and I knew he'd add up my answer to make sure it came to a billion, and if it didn't, then he'd embarrass me. So I was ready, but I have to be honest, it was a bit of a stretch to figure out how you come up with a billion. Well, then my secretary of administration and finance, after I got elected, came into my office and said, "Mitt, we have some good news and bad news. The good news is we don't have a $1 billion shortfall." That's the good news. The bad news is we have a $3 billion shortfall. And we went to work figuring out how we're going to balance that. And interestingly, we got the job done. And we got it done by the same approach that you would that you would in any kind of setting, which is we did not raise taxes because taxes would hurt working families, would scare away jobs. The business community, by the way, was interested in us raising debt. Just go out and borrow money to fill in the gap. But we'd already borrowed a lot, and we didn't want to put that kind of a burden on our citizens long term, so we didn't borrow. Instead, we went to work and cut costs where we could, cut out programs we didn't think were terribly efficient, looked for waste and inefficiency everywhere we could. There were some fees that had been undercharged in the past. We raised some fees, and we were able to balance our budget, a $3 billion shortfall, and get ourselves back on track. And by the way, over the last 2 years, our surplus is in excess of about $1 billion. So it's coming along pretty well. By the way, how do you do that? What's the approach? One of my favorite stories is dealing with one topic that I did not want to hurt in any way, and that was our provision of care for the homeless. We have a large homeless population. We spend about $130 million on the homeless, and I said I will not cut the budget for the homeless. But when I was looking at the statistics, the numbers, I saw this line in there for hotels. And I said, what is that, hotels? And they said, well, when someone arrives at a homeless shelter, and if the shelter is full, then we direct them to go to a hotel. And my thought was, that's not the kind of incentive you want to create. Because so we began by changing our program to say, if someone arrives at a homeless shelter and we're full, we invite them to come into the shelter, and the person who's been in the shelter the longest, they will go to the hotel. At the time I became governor, I asked how many people are in hotels a night. We had as many as 600 hotel rooms a night, spending over $20 million a year on hotels. Leona Helmsley was delighted with us. And we changed the program, and now we have zero people in hotels. Instead, we're able to use those funds to help people get permanent housing and get on their feet again. And by the way, we also didn't cut education either. One of the things I'm most proud of is that we were able to put in place a scholarship program called the Abigail and John Adams Scholarship. Today in Massachusetts, if you graduate in the top 25% of your high school class, you're entitled to go to any state college or university tuition-free for 4 years. So you can choose priorities, effectively marshal your resources, and solve some pretty difficult problems. When I took office, someone you may know named Tom Stemberg was the founder of Staples and its chief executive. He said, you know, if you really want to help people, Mitt, you don't want to just be the guy who balances budgets. You want to be able to make a difference in people's lives. If you want to be able to do that, and I did, and I do, you're going to have to find a way to get everybody in Massachusetts health insurance. Boy, isn't that the holy grail? For people who've looked at problems that our nation faces, it's 40 million nationally, and for me, a 500,000 people in my state without health insurance. And we went to work seeing if we could find a way to do that. Now, as in all things that are important, you begin with some principles. And some of the principles in my mind were, well, one, we don't want a government takeover. Hillary care is not the answer. Two, we want the market system to work, because the market has proven time and again the most effective way to deal with the needs of our society. Three, we don't want to raise taxes and put in place some new bureaucracy that's going to cost us tons and tons of money. And we wondered, was it possible, given that framework, to find a way to ensure all of our citizens? And we got a lot of people that did a lot of analysis. My team went to work. Some folks from MIT came in and did some economic analysis. We had a number of the providers, hospitals, do some work with us. The insurance companies helped us understand why the problem persisted. We went out and did interviews to find out who the people were that were without insurance. We presumed they were all very low income, mostly single moms that couldn't afford insurance. We found out they were mostly male. Almost all had graduated from high school, many from college. 100,000 of our roughly 500,000 were earning $75,000 a year or more and didn't choose to buy insurance. So our whole mindset changed as we found out who we were dealing with, and then we found a solution. We laid that solution out. I'm pleased that we've provided it to our state legislature. They've also worked on their own plan. They're similar in some respects. I think we'll actually have reform in our state this year passed that will lead to everybody being insured with a market-based insurance product that doesn't raise our taxes and that allows the market to solve the problems of one of the great problems in our nation. Of course, my state is also impacted not just by what happens in our borders, but by what happens nationally. And I don't pretend to have all the answers, particularly on things I haven't studied and the kind of depth that I get to study in my own state. But I do believe that as a nation, we can dissect some of our toughest problems, get the data, analyze it, synthesize it, and come up with solutions that will ultimately lead to the the overwhelming as some of the challenges we face. Let me just mention a few of those problems and some ideas at this stage. I believe that as a nation we face perhaps one of the great critical times in our history. I think we've gone through an inflection point in how the world works. I think that inflection point is pointed out by many writers. Tom Friedman in his book, The World is Flat, Fareed Zakaria, one of your members, in his book on democracy and so forth, are pointing out that things have changed. I think we've gone from a world which used to be large and bureaucratic to one which is fast-moving and agile, where enterprise, to be successful, has to move very, very quickly, where, if you will, the JetBlues of the world surpass the Delta and the United Airlines because they're burdened, and the General Motors get overwhelmed by companies that can move much, much more quickly, and that's true with governments and military and so forth. We are under attack, in my view, on three dimensions. Which are all impacted by that. One is a military attack, where a small band of maniacal, murdering terrorists have taken on the largest nation in the world and have successfully threatened us and attacked us in our home. And as we look at that kind of attack, we recognize that we are fortunate to have a president who recognizes its significance. And has been willing to declare a war on something so enormous. This is not a group of people who are just intent on setting off some bombs in shopping centers, awful as that would be. They want to overthrow the government of the United States of America and bankrupt, almost bankrupt, our economy and cause us to become impoverished. That is their desire. And we have to recognize we have a real attack, and the president has recognized it and has called a war, and has called it a war. We also recognize that the battlefield of Iraq is not exactly the most ideal place in the world where you're going to try and establish democracy, but it's the one that we've been given. I do not believe we should cut and run at this stage. I don't believe that it would be appropriate for us to see helicopters with the people going off the top of the embassy as we did in my youth, and I guess it wasn't really youth, in my early years from Vietnam. There was no question about whether Ho Chi Minh was going to attack the United States or whether Ho Chi Minh would attack other countries around him. That was not the case. On the other hand, with Al-Qaeda and the terrorists that we're considering today, it is a conflict which they began and which they will continue. Protection of our homeland has begun. But I'm very concerned about the fact that our protective efforts are largely just that, protecting assets and response to crisis. And I believe that our resources should be far more focused on prevention of attack. And the only way I know to prevent attack is by having an effective intelligence capability domestically and abroad to understand who the bad guys are and getting them out of our country before they attack us here. And it's a little dispiriting, I must admit, to have spent as much as we have in response, which is overwhelmingly where our resources go, is in response following 9/11, how to respond better when the bomb goes off and when the crisis occurs, and then to see what happened in Louisiana, where with all the spending we do and all the planning we did, not a job, which as the president said was an unacceptable job in Louisiana. We also have to develop as a nation a strategy to deal with the anger and the frustration that young Arab men feel who are not engaged in the world economic setting, who don't have the kind of education that allows them to do so. And I think we also have to recognize that the terrorism and the Arab extremism is not the last military challenge this nation will ever face. We will continue to face challenges into our future. Now, there's a second attack area, an economic attack. I sat down with a chief executive officer who I know well. He is a manufacturer of high-tech instruments and devices. And I was asking him about his manufacturing and how it's going to change over the next decade. And he said, Mitt, over the next 10 years, I expect that 90% of our manufacturing will move to Asia. And I was shocked because this is high-end manufacturing, high-tech, high-end. And I said, what, are you going over there for low wages? And he said, no, I'm going over there because that's where I can find the skilled workforce I need. That's where I can find the engineers. That's where I can find the superior suppliers. The cutting-edge suppliers in my industry are increasingly over there. And I wondered if he was right. And then I saw some statistics, and you've seen them. China today graduates 5 times as many engineers as America. Look at the statistics on PhDs. 15 years ago, Asian countries collectively graduated about 4,700 PhDs in math and sciences, physical sciences a year. And we did the same, the United States. So the United States was the same as all the rest of Asia combined. Today, we're still at the same level, roughly 4,700 per year, PhDs. They're at 24,900 a year, investing in their future and in technology. China is unlike the kind of competition we've faced before. It's not like a country that's interested in making Christmas tree ornaments for America and toys. They want to make MRI machines and jumbo jets and create new patents for drugs. Bill Gates quoted, I think it was in Tom Friedman's book, Bill Gates quoted as saying his operation in Beijing is coming up with the best ideas for software anywhere in the world. This is a people who are ambitious, dedicated, hardworking, educated, family-oriented, extremely mercantile, successful in so many pursuits. It's wonderful. Isn't it great to watch a people who've been extraordinarily impoverished over centuries rising into the marketplace, taking advantage of some of the free enterprise principles, at least in one aspect of their life, that allows them to see a higher standard of living. It means they'll be able to be purchasers of products from our country. It's a great opportunity for us, and it's wonderful for them, but it's also a threat. Recognize that this is a place which is a very serious competitor, and they don't want to just supply goods to us. They want to see the center of manufacturing and innovation move from North America to Asia, and to China in particular, just like we would if we lived there. And they're going to make a real run for it. Now, I'm convinced, of course, that we're going to win that battle, but who was it? Will Rogers, who said, even if you're on the right track, if you're not moving, you'll get run over. And America's on the right track, but we're awfully complacent. My dad had a favorite statement that he used to tell us all the time, because he was head of a little car company called American Motors, and I used to wonder how in the world he could compete with the big guys. And he said, there's nothing as vulnerable as entrenched success. And we are the ultimately entrenched successful country, feeling that we're the economic superpower and the military superpower, and we are. But to maintain that superiority means a constant vigilance and a constant investment in the future. There are a number of things I think we have to do. One, I think we have to raise the bar in education. I had a wonderful chat with Roger Herzog, who said, look, the McKinsey Institute's done some work looking at education, and average education level doesn't correlate very well with productivity in various countries around the world. And he may be right on that. And yet I'm absolutely convinced that average education level does impact the overall capability of an economy to compete. And at the very highest level, the PhDs and master's degrees and brilliant minds that a particular country has are an extraordinarily powerful source of its future economic strength. And therefore, pushing our kids harder, not just no child left behind, but also no child held back. Push our kids. Let the very brightest go as far as they possibly can. We have to raise the bar in education. I'm convinced we have to invest more in innovation. We do a great job at the National Institutes of Health. The investments there lead to all sorts of health products. We do well in our military investments in technology. We lead the world in both areas. Why can't we do the same in material science and in transportation technologies and in power generation and so forth and so on? Make investments as a society in science, basic science, that will continue to have our nation lead. And by the way, that's investment dollars that go into institutions of higher learning where our kids can be pushed further and further and can raise the bar higher and higher. Immigration. I'd like to see it made a lot easier for people who have advanced degrees and have accomplished great things come to this country and become citizens of this country. Let's get them on this team and make sure that every possible legal immigrant we can get who has the skills and ambition and education and a desire to be here, welcome them to our country and find that they can be with us over the long haul. I'd like to reduce the burdens we place on our employers. Boy, we put a lot of fat and a lot of weight around those enterprises that we're counting on to compete globally. The tax structure of the U.S. is a cumbersome and difficult system to operate. Our tort system is confiscatory in many cases. Our health care system. Look, our businesses are having to carry the cost of the unemployed because somebody has to pay. I don't mean the unemployed. I meant the uninsured. The uninsured are being, it's not people who are uninsured get health care, as you know. They get health care. They just don't have insurance. They don't get it in the most effective and efficient manner, and it's paid for by everybody else who's paying for insurance. So you're paying for your own, or the company that hires you is paying for your coverage, plus people who don't have insurance. Let's get everybody insured, and you'll find, if we ever get a close look at it, you'll find that in our state we've got a way of doing that by insisting on personal responsibility. Well, I think finally I'd indicate that we have to use our bargaining power with the Chinese while we have it and while they care. I want to make sure that our intellectual property rights are protected. I want to make sure that their markets are open to our products. I do not want to build up barriers between our country and their country. That is, I wish it were as simple as just saying, let's put big tariffs on. That doesn't work. The communist world tried that, and it is not the answer. There's a third attack, and then I'll stop here. There's a third attack that I think our country faces, and that's with regards to what are the values and the culture of our society. I read not long ago, I can't remember the name of the author, you'll blurt it out, but the book Germs, Guns, and Steel, I may have been in the wrong order, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Who wrote that? Thank you. And it's been a while. And I read the book, and it just didn't feel right. It didn't seem to explain the world to me. And I recognize there are huge differences in natural resources and the flow of rivers and whether an area has iron ore or not. And yet you look at different peoples that have gone into very hostile territory, and somehow some people end up time and time again doing extraordinarily well economically. I read another book more recently by David Landis, professor at Harvard. On the jacket, there was a great quote in there by John Kenneth Galbraith, and I thought, oh, no, this is going to be some liberal diatribe, and I'm not going to be able to handle it. But I actually liked it a lot. It was about 500 pages of good analytical work and a lot of data. And then he ends with this quote, not exactly at the end, but pretty close. He says, if we are to learn anything from the history of economic development, it is this: culture makes all the difference. And he looks at the different cultures of different lands and of different peoples and the impact that that's had on their economic development. Now, I'm not sure what your perspective is on what is the American culture. He doesn't go on to try and define that terribly precisely, but I do in my own mind. I think about what is the culture of this land. In my opinion, people who come here are people who seek opportunity first. It's a country based on give me an opportunity to achieve. People come here who are willing to work and work hard. People believe in individual responsibility. People here believe in sacrificing now for a greater future. People believe in families. We come here, we form family units, and we build those families and invest in our children and in their future. I believe that those are the fundamental features of our land. We also, by the way, were people who are willing to help out. I got criticized recently because of the hurricane victims. I was, and I'm very excited about the fact that we're able in my state to welcome some hurricane victims to our state, and we're going to be extraordinarily generous as a state in caring for them. And I was delighted to see people of all different walks and stripes generating or contributing generously to the relief effort. And what some people don't understand, and one person just said, you know, the governor's really good to these people that are coming from the hurricane, but why isn't he better to the poor that are here? Well, I take exception. I think I do a great job for the poor that are here. But I also think there's a big difference in the mind of Americans to providing a helping hand and providing a handout on a permanent basis. And if somebody is down, if they've been knocked down, boy, we'll do anything to help them get back on their feet. But one thing we won't do is to say, for the rest of your life, you'll never have to work again. We'll just take care of you. Because that will create an intoxication, a lifestyle that is deadening to them, to their children, and to our society. Well, those are some of the American values. And I would say, and let me just, I keep on saying I'm going to end, so you're getting very excited, and then I don't end. I remember that. Remember Felix Frankfurter, Justice Frankfurter. His wife said to him, "You only make two mistakes in your speeches. One is when you divert from your text, and the other is when you return to it." But I will divert from my text just to tell you that I am very optimistic about this land and about our future, because I believe in the heart of the people of America. I believe in the culture of America. I believe it is imbued in our children's hearts. I believe that we will always rise to the occasion as we always have. We have been asleep at the switch before as a land. Then there's a wake-up call, and we wake up. The sleeping giant wakes up, and we will do it again and again. I saw it at the Olympics. I have so many stories from that. I'll tell you one about Vonetta Flowers, just to mention one. I saw the kind of character that reminded me why I love this land and why I love its people. Vonetta Flowers is probably not a name you know. Women's bobsledder. Our Olympics were the first Olympics to have women's bobsledding. Never been in before because the International Olympic Committee said that bobsledding was too dangerous for women. So we fought and we got it into our games. And very excited about it. And Vanetta Flowers was excited. She's on USA Sled 2. USA Sled 2, as its number indicates, doesn't typically come in first. It comes in second, third, fourth, or fifth in the world competitions on the World Cup. And Vanetta is the brakeman. That's the person, probably the most important. She is the one that gets the thing started. She pushes it and then, of course, puts in the brakes at the end if they're needed, which they're typically not. But she's the one that gives it the push at the beginning. Sled 1 was going to get the gold medal for sure. Jean Racine, best pilot in the world. And Jean Racine was going to take that Sled 1 and get us a gold medal. We were sure to get a gold in women's bobsled. That would help our medals count. Well, as we got closer to the Olympics, Jean Racine said, I want to change my brakeman on Sled 1 and invite Vanetta Flowers from Sled 2 to come over and be my brakeman. And she made the invitation. And we all hoped that Vanetta would go because that meant a gold for us. We needed her there. And Vanetta had a tough decision because if she went from Sled 2 to Sled 1, she would become the first African-American, male or female, to get a gold medal in the Winter Olympics. A lot of African-American medals, of course, in the Summer Olympics. But in the winter, not before. She'd be the first and the first woman to get a gold medal in bobsled because it was the first time the sport had been at the Olympics. But she decided not to go. She decided to stay in sled, too. A number of us were very disappointed. And she explained that she had worked and trained for several years and competed with her partner, Jill Bakken, and they were friends, and she felt that loyalty was more important than winning the gold. And boy, that hit us hard, and it taught us a lesson. By the way, you may or may not have watched women's bobsled as one of the top events at the games. Sled 1 did masterfully well. The Europeans, of course, did very, very well. Actually, some bested Sled 1, but when Sled 2 beat them all, and Jill won the gold medal, and that night when she's on the podium getting the gold medal put around her neck and tears running down her cheeks, we recognize the power of her story. And by the way, after that, we heard she was pregnant at the time. She hadn't told anybody. Quite a hero. America is filled with heroes, with heroic hearts, people who believe in this land and what it stands for and the great qualities of the human spirit. And it is those qualities and those beliefs which give me my optimism and my belief that regardless of the challenges we face, this land will be a blessed and successful land. Thank you so much.
The governor's agreed to answer some questions. I'm going to field the questions because I'm more familiar with the audience. And once I acknowledge you, just please wait for the hand mic so that everybody can pick up your question, all right? So why don't you just raise your hands and we'll... Okay, Michael?
Michael needs no mic, but go ahead.
I'm Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. You sounded very much like a presidential candidate in 2008. Are you? that's my first question. My second question, which is more substantive, is that the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina has seen a lot of partisan bickering over race and poverty issues and over responsibility and accountability. My question to you, therefore, is what was needed? What was needed to be done? And what still needs to be done to overcome the racial divide in Massachusetts and the United States in general?
Those are obviously big questions. Not all of them, though. The first one is I am not a candidate for anything besides governor. I'm happy to be governor, and I love my job and am focused on that job. Time will tell what the future holds, but I'm loving the job I've got, as you may be able to tell, and my highest priority is finding out a way to get a health insurance package passed in Massachusetts that gets every citizen insured. So that's what I'm focused on. As with regards to what happened at the hurricane and what the causes were, it is fair to say that I come from a view that the governor of a state is responsible for the homeland security and emergency response capabilities of a state. And if we have a crisis in my state, the buck stops here. If a governor finds that a crisis is upon him or her that is larger than their resources can deal with, then they call upon the federal government or surrounding states. In our case, we have compacts with our surrounding National Guard states, and we tell them what we want them to do. And we expect them to do it in the time frame that's needed. And so that's the structure. Now, if a governor and I, you know, Haley Barbour in Mississippi and we got a number of states that were affected, each of them had their own plans. I don't think we're at a point yet to do the analysis of which one was done right, which one was not, where was the fault, how could it have been done better. Time will allow us to do that. I do believe that the perception, if you will, I began by talking about the old way, which are big bureaucratic organizations that deal, if you will, the old General Motors and the United Airlines, and then the fast and agile kind of organizations. I think the new model is really what's essential in dealing with a crisis. In our own state, when we first started planning for how we were going to accept the evacuees into our state, we began thinking in our, you know, let's ask the fire department what they're going to do. Let's ask the police department what they're going to do. Let's ask social services what they're going to do. Instead of saying, okay, let's decide who's going to be responsible for them when they get here. How do we get them into the airport? Then who's going to be responsible for housing them temporarily? Then who's going to be responsible for getting them into the community? What I'm pointing is that typically we respond according to bureaucracy and plans, documents. And in crisis situations, you have to respond with leadership, with a strong leader who says, I'm in charge here. I'm making the decisions. You do this. You do that. You get this over here. And that's what you have to have. And typically in a state emergency setting, that would be the governor. Let's say you had a governor that couldn't do that very well. Might be the head of the state emergency management agency, or the head of public safety, or it could be any number of other people. But you have to have a leader somewhere. You have to have someone who grabs the reins and says, here's how it's going to get done. And will they make mistakes? Sure. But what I saw, at least in the TV coverage of the crisis, was the apparent absence at the state and local level or on the ground of somebody who was calling the shots and saying, bring this here and bring that there. It's impossible to be able to tell from a distance what's needed. There has to be somebody right there on the spot. And most of us watching TV thought we could have done a better job from our sofas. We couldn't, of course, but it seemed to be more of a clear lack of leadership on the spot. Your last question about the racial divide, in my opinion, the great civil rights issue of our day is education. And the inability of our schools to provide equal educational outcomes for inner city residents and largely people of minority ethnic backgrounds, and that's a large and complex topic. And I will be introducing legislation this fall which seeks to address the achievement gap. But until as long as we're going to continue to have ethnic minorities receiving an education which is inferior, then economic opportunities are going to also be inferior. Yes, Peter. Yeah, Peter. Oh, I'm sorry.
Governor, in your legislation that you're going to introduce this fall, do you believe that the inner city public school system can be made workable from within, giving principals more authority, et cetera? Or do you believe that it needs a more systemic change, such as giving parents the right to choose the school to which their children go?
I think all of the above. Almost every idea ought to be implemented. I do believe that school choice is critical. We have in our state charter schools. They're highly popular, and they're doing well. The very best are doing superbly, and the great thing is that the very poorest we close down. Unlike public schools, when a public school doesn't work, we just keep on putting more money in. With a charter school, we revoke their charter after a period of time and close them down. And our very best are doing very well indeed. I do believe that one of the fundamental things we have to consider also is the parent and the parent's involvement in the education process. And I proposed before and will propose again that we have parental preparation courses that are mandatory for the parents of kids in failing school districts. I took our bottom 10% of the school districts and said, I'd like to take the parents that are sending kids to those schools and help the parents understand how they can support their child's education. What TV to watch, what TV not to watch, what after-school programs are available in the community, what books you can read, how discipline works in a school. There are some people who come here from cultures where education has not been as critical to their success in the future. Help the parents understand just the extraordinary significance of education in this culture and in our economy. And that's something which I think is critical. I also think that we're going to have to address out-of-wedlock births if we're going to ultimately deal with the need for two parents wherever possible and helping raise children. We have 30% roughly of kids in America born today that are to single parents, and in our cities, it's a higher percent than that. And I think we're going to have to provide education to our kids. Get married first before you have kids.
Governor, Max. I'm curious about, you talked a little bit about the war on terrorism and defense and foreign policy. What do you see as the biggest shortcoming of the way that President Bush has approached the war on terrorism, and what specifically would you do to change it if you do get into a position to change it? I mean, you talked a little bit about the need for better intelligence, but a lot of people talk about the need for better intelligence, and obviously there's been a huge overhaul of the intelligence community, which has been underway. I mean, what specifically do you think should be done differently?
Well, let me talk about the homeland side of that for a moment. And this is something which is not just the president. This is something which we as a nation and as states and cities are going to have to come to grips with ourselves. If we're very serious about intelligence, we're going to have to invest a great deal more, either in the FBI and in their domestic intelligence capability, or in state and local intelligence capability. I was able to help form a task force and led a task force to suggest what each state should be doing. We concluded that each state should have a fusion center where we gather criminal information at the state level, analyze it, and provide it to the federal government. But we did not recommend that states put in place intelligence gathering capability, meaning agents going either overseas or monitoring and wiretapping in this country. We said it probably doesn't make sense to have each state and each city doing that. Now, New York does it. New York has a very extensive intelligence capability. New York City does. But we said that's probably not something the rest of the country can duplicate. Instead, we looked to the federal government to establish a very extensive intelligence capability through the, presumably through the FBI, but through someone. Choose someone. The Department of Defense, Justice, but let some agency take primary leader. Today it's the FBI. We have Homeland Security. I think there was some question, well, is it Homeland Security or is it the FBI? Well, Homeland Security doesn't have intelligence data gathering. The FBI does. Then let's invest in a far larger number of people to evaluate intelligence information and identify who are the people that pose risks to our society and have them removed from our society. Now, with regards to the conduct of the battlefield outside the U.S., that's clearly a large topic. I don't know whether you wanted me to get into that or not, I think I said at the beginning, getting into Iraq was based upon mistaken intelligence in terms of weapons of mass destruction. We are there. Now that we are there, the question is, what do we do? And I think both John Kerry and George W. Bush had the same conclusion. You can't cut and run. What's the best way to get out? Obviously by having the people in their own country responsible for their own security. And how can you quickly move to that course is something which everybody agrees upon, which is you want to do it as quickly as humanly possible. The challenge, I think, that we're going to have to address is how do we keep this happening again and again and again and again in Arab land or where there are fundamentalist members of Islam around the world? And how can we take a very young and very angry population that is disengaged from the world economy and the world educational community and find a way to engage them in that community? That's ultimately what's going to have to happen if we're going to reduce the level of anger, despair, and terror.
Byron Wien.
This education problem has been on the table for a long time. Mm-hmm. and we seem to be losing ground in terms of our ability to turn out scientific graduate students in the sciences and mathematics. I wonder whether we have a problem in that the teachers, that we don't have an adequate level of inspirational teachers to get these students riled up about this field. And I also wonder whether the incentives, the financial incentives, the career incentives in the sciences aren't as great as they are in the hedge fund community and certain other fields that seem to attract it. I work for a financial institution, and we have an incredible number of people who have majored in math and science who have chosen that field to pursue their careers. So that's why it isn't just that we're not turning out enough graduates. those graduates aren't staying in the field. What can we do about that?
Well, there's no question. Those who can find their way into your hedge fund will do so. But it's a limited marketplace, and we'll fill those spots. And then we have another, several million people a year that come out of colleges that are going to need jobs, and those jobs are gone. And then the question is, what's the next best opportunity? And it is typically in innovation and science and math-based types of positions. And our kids don't realize that when they're going to college. They don't recognize that that's where the job opportunities are. And we need to do a much better job communicating that throughout the education system, that great jobs in this country, where are the great jobs in this country? Where's the great pay? Where are the great careers? And they'll find that many of them are in math and science. In my state, I hear time and again from people the need to find people that have the kind of education that they need to excel in math and science. I was at Raytheon Corporation recently. I can't remember the number. I think it's 1,400 a year engineers they try and hire, and they say they're just not able to do so. They're looking to find new sources, and they continue to look overseas. And they're, it's a great paying company with great prospects. I think you hit the nail on the head with the beginning of your question, which is teachers that are not excited about math and science, teaching kids who therefore are not going to be excited about it either. Nationwide, if you're in middle school and you're taking a science class, the probability that your teacher majored or minored in math or science is 7%. 93% majored in other things. So if you're learning science from someone who didn't love science, who may have been afraid of science, the likelihood that you're going to love it and get engaged in it is not very high. And I believe that we should make it a lot easier for people who have master's and advanced degrees in sciences to get into teaching. I would like to pay our science and math teachers more money. I'd like the union to allow us to finally pay more money to people in math and science who have math and science backgrounds and are superb, exciting teachers. I can't wait to pay more money to teachers. Teachers, the best teachers are underpaid. The worst are way overpaid. We've got to find a way to get more money to the best teachers so that we can draw some of the very best from our society into teaching. That's our investment in the future. It's the ultimate American culture and value to invest in the future, to invest in our teachers. But let's have the very best and the brightest, not just those. Today we treat teachers as if they're manufacturing widgets. They're compensated entirely based on their tenure. They're locked in a grid. They move together. Those that have ambition and dreams leave teaching. And those that many of those that don't end up staying longer than they should. And I'd like to find a way to make the very best and the brightest in science and math choose teaching as a profession. And I think that would have a marked impact on our kids, plus letting our kids know what the economic prospects are if they get a background in math and science.
Okay, John, did you have a question? And then the gentleman in the corner.
What did you cut to get from $3 billion in the hole to a $1 billion surplus? What went away?
Well, we got rid of agencies. We had some of you know Boston pretty well. We had we have three highway departments in Massachusetts. We have the Turnpike Authority, the Highway Department, and the MDC, the Metropolitan District Commission. Each of them manages highways. Two of them manage parks. We got rid of one, and we combined personnel and saved personnel by doing that. We were ranked the state that reduced reduced municipal and state employment more than any other state in America. So we cut back. We cut back in spending in a wide range of areas where we believed we could pare back to the essential and cut out some of the non-essential. In some of our training programs, we have 13 different job training programs, approximately, in Massachusetts. We decided to focus on that, which we thought was the most effective, the one-stop career centers. So we focused our resources there. Basically, we pulled back in those agencies or those areas where we thought we were not particularly effective. And by the way, as I said, we invested more in education. We never cut education, never cut our education spending, did not cut our funding for the unemployed, for the homeless. And we did cut back on the money that we send to cities and towns. We cut that. It had not been cut in a long time. We cut that. And so there were some efficiencies and some cutbacks in places that we thought we were going to be able to still achieve our social purposes and our human services needs without sacrificing those things, but still balancing our budget. And I think we did so successfully.
My question regards, My question regards cultural gaps in education. My experience is that teachers don't know how to deal with what Marx called the lumpen proletariat. And in international affairs, I remember 1954, Guatemala and Iran, and there was a couple of nice guys in both countries who were meaning well, but we decided they were commies, and we got rid of them, and instead we had Guatemala dictatorship and thousands killed, and we had the Shah put in, and we know what happened in Iran. I'm wondering what your perception is how to resolve these cultural differences, both on an international scale and on a domestic scale.
I'm not sure that I'm up to solving the cultural differences and the gaps that exist between our cultures. Samuel Huntington, you know, in his book *Clash of Civilizations*, points out the conflict between civilizations. I don't believe that we should try and homogenize the civilizations of the world. I don't think that's the answer. I think we let people pursue the values and the cultures which they have and embrace them. But I do believe that we have to move towards modernity. I believe that we do have to have all the nations of the world ultimately adopt principles that allow individuals of both genders to receive education. Or otherwise, you basically will have a society. If one society says that women cannot participate either in education or in the economics of their society, they will always be an inferior society economically. We have to find ways to bring people into modernity, and I think that can happen within the cultural realities. And I think that will happen over time. The question is, during this period of transition, we have a great deal of anger, particularly on the part of fundamentalists among Arab youth. Let me also just I didn't give John enough of an answer. I got a list of all the things we did to save money. Let me tell you some of the biggest. I forgot a couple that I was interested in. One of the things during the debate everybody talks about is how much money we spend on drugs. And in our state, when you think of all the drugs we buy for people that are receiving state-paid-for health care, our drug cost, the total dollars we spent on pharmaceuticals per year, was growing 18, then 16, then 14% a year. Last year, we shrunk it by 1%. Now, we did that through a lot of vehicles. We did better purchasing. We put in place a formulary that we thought was more effective. And on the basis of those and other measures, we were able to get our drug costs down dramatically. We also had, like most states, we had Medicaid growing at a very high rate, again in the double-digit rate. Medicaid for us this last year grew at 5.5%. So we've been able to bring down some of the runaway costs with which other states have incurred. And we did it agency by agency. I wish I could tell you, oh, we just went in there and got rid of this or got rid of that. We streamlined Health and Human Services. I had, I think, 16 agencies. We put them into 4. And, yeah, we saved by doing that. But fundamentally, it was looking at every single thing we did, from health care, purchasing drugs, to the structure of state government, everything we did, and to say, can we do that more effectively and more efficiently? And for those of you in the private sector, it is hard to explain what it's like in government. It was such an awakening for me. I came into office, and after I was there a few weeks, I said, where are the monthly reports? And they said, what monthly reports? And I said, you know, the things that show how many prisoners we have and how many are out this month and what's the rate of recidivism, how many policemen we have, what the average compensation is, how many women in the workforce, how many men, how many African Americans in positions of leadership. Nothing. I said, well, do my cabinet members have reports? No. And so we did what Rudy Giuliani did here. We began gathering the data, putting together. We now have a book that's about 4 inches in thickness called our benchmark report. So we look at everything that's going on in state government and measure how we're doing. And we're doing pretty well in some things, not so well in others. I mean, I looked at some things. We had some backlogs. People would look for a permit, an environmental permit, or let's say an inspection for an elevator. They might wait 2 years for that to get done. It's just unbelievable. And so we did find a lot. It's not so much waste. It's not that it's fraud. It's just that it's going back 30 or 40 years and seeing business practices or management practices that haven't been employed in our country in decades still existing in government. And you can slowly but surely make those kinds of changes. That's why we're able to get our drug costs down, why we get our Medicaid costs down. It's changing incentives like we did with our homeless. Thanks. I apologize. We got to let people go back to work.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty rough to adjourn, but I want to thank the governor for coming.
Thank you. Good to be with you.